Because we all know you're not doing physics right now.
Berlinski?
By the way, the lecture is not going to be so much on about my research. I'll try to give you some sort of more general feel for what particle physics is all about. But maybe here and there I'll tell you what I'm actually interested in. Where do we start? I think it's fair to say that particle physics as a discipline sort of started with Rutherford in 1911. And I don't know how many of you have ever seen that or have gone through what he has done. What Rutherford has done is that he collided helium nuclei with gold. If I remember correctly. Hi.
How are you? I'm Amanda.
Hello, Amanda.
Good to meet you. I'm not
sure that's true. Yeah, I think I can even hear my echo. So,
thank you.
You're welcome. So what Rutherford has done is that he's taken helium that comes out of the radioactive decay of a certain element and bombarded it against a thin filament of gold, if I remember correctly. And the results of these experiments have changed the course of science forever. Because the results of these experiments, unlike what was expected, gave an indication that matter is really made of particles and not some gooey thing in which electrons swim in. So you probably heard this story before. There were basically two competing models. One of them, the electrons were already known at that time. One of them was that electrons are somehow embedded in some gooey materials that make the whole thing neutral. But then there was the other option that somehow there is some positive charges everywhere that neutralize it. And what he measured a cross-section. Now, a cross-section is a classical thing. If your rocket is drifting towards the Earth, there is some cross-section for that rocket to hit the Earth. And if there is no gravity, then that cross-section is basically just the geometrical area of the Earth, right? Similarly, you can ask, what is the cross-section? How many times will these helium nuclei scatter as they shatter against the gold foil, right? And what you do is that you derive a formula for that cross-section. So this is basically how many of them will scatter into a certain angle, right? So you scatter here, and you scatter into a certain angle. Right? Now, I'm actually going to write this formula because this business of scattering is maybe one of the most fundamental objects of particle physics. If you cannot calculate a cross-section, you're probably not really doing particle physics. Which is OK, but you're not doing particle physics. So here it is. And I'm writing it just so that we can discuss it a little bit. There are several very important things happening here. One of them is the appearance of alpha, which is the fine structure constant. And that's telling you how strongly these helium nuclei interact with the gold foil. And this angle is telling you how the thing diverges, right? Now, this cross-section is the cross-section you will get if you actually scatter against particles. If you scatter against gooey material, that's not what you're going to get. And this is what Rutherford observed, and in particular, he observed scattering at very large angles, which this formula predicts, right? If you scatter against the gooey stuff, you will never scatter back. If you scatter against particles, you will. There are several things that came out of this. First is the realizations that there are some charged plus particles swimming around in matter, and those are, of course, the protons. But that also means that matter is really some sort of aggregation of bound states of electrons revolving around protons, right? So already here, very early on, we see some deep connection between scattering experiments, where you just take a bunch of stuff and collide it against another, and bound states, and that is some systems that are made of particles and are bounded together, Okay, and I'm going to say much more about this soon, but two very fundamental concepts in particle physics is that of a scattering and that of a bound state. Now, aside from what it teaches you about what matter is made of, it's also teaching you how matter is interacting, right? So you now know that there are protons, but you also know that the nuclei here interacted only through electromagnetism with that proton, right? So it's telling you also about the forces. Now the reason why this experiment was so important is not just because it taught us, oh, there is another particle in the universe. And one thing that I want to really emphasize for you is particle physics is not just about the enumeration of we have this meson and that hadron and that pion. That's not what it's about. It's part of the story. It's part of what allows us to make some much deeper connections with nature. And in particular, already here we see a very deep statement about nature. Because this system is unstable classically. Right? The moment you really realize, and people have, that this is what's happening, you immediately get into a paradox. This thing will not be stable classically, so you just concluded that matter is not stable. And all of it is coming out of just shattering one form of matter against another. Right? And this, of course, is part of what led Bohr to his model and ultimately to quantum mechanics. So you see here that even though what we started with is something so mundane as colliding helium against gold foils, and it seems like we're just enumerating the number of particles, and we'll see, and this sort of exploded in the 50s when they found, you know, 50s and hundreds of particles. Really, at the bottom of it is that we're after new principles of nature. And this example here illustrates it very, very clearly that by the moment you realize that this is what the matter is made of, you have stumbled across quantum mechanics. Okay? And I'll give you a couple more examples like that. Okay. Let me tell you a few more things about it. So this bound state system is such that it was even further studied later on, and the first predictions of quantum field theory emerged out of it in the form of the lamp shift. Okay, so not only did we get quantum mechanics out of it, you start getting quantum field theory out of it. All right. So let's just do a little table here of what we had back then and what we have now. So actually, I should never erase that scattering. States. Then now. So as I said, one of the very early things that happened in scattering is the Rutherford experiment, and that taught us about the existence of the proton. And by the way, there's another really, really deep thing that if you really thought about it very carefully, you would come to realize. And again, it illustrates the power of scattering. If you really have those protons there in as a nuclei, well, gold really has many more than one proton, right? So how come all of those things are sitting together tight in a femtometer, right? If you really think about it very carefully, you would realize that not only is this bound system unstable, but rather even the nucleus is an unstable system, right? And that will lead you to the realization that there is another force in the game, and that is the strong force. So scattering experiments not only do they teach us about a new principle, which is by itself very cool, they also teach us very often about new forces that are in the game. And here it's clearly the case, because there's no way this is electromagnetically stable. We just have too many charges sitting around. And you'll see in a moment this strong force coming again. This is what happened in 1911. But by the way, I should say, you should feel free to interject with any questions, but I assume it's very informal, right? What is happening, so this was, very, very low energies of like a few MeV, right? Today we're talking about energies of 10 TeV. That's actually precisely the energy of the LHC. So for those of you who have heard about the LHC, it's a big collider at Geneva. And today the center of mass energy is 10 TeV, which is a factor of 10 million larger than where we were in 100 years ago. Actually, that's nice. Exactly 100 years ago, 1911. So in 100 years, we have gone up by a factor of 10 to the 7, right? So 100 years, 10 to the 7 increase in energy. Unfortunately, it's rather unlikely we will experience another increase like that in the next 100 years. But one should not lose hope. So maybe. But this is truly impressive. But much more has happened than just an increase in energy. Over the period of these 100 years, we have discovered hundreds of particles, right? And one big thing that happened in the 50s is that there was just this exponentiation of number of particles that we saw. And those particles were actually strongly interacting. There was no obvious way how to calculate the results, the cross-sections, right? And this was our first experience with strong interactions in particle physics. And it's very much related to this force that is holding the nucleus together. We found out that force is also participating in the creation of other particles like mesons, pions, that were first observed in the atmosphere. As some of you may know, you're constantly being bombarded by particles. Those are particles that are coming from cosmic rays. They penetrate through the atmosphere and hit you. Well, hit you very, very rarely. They're composed of, protons, neutrons, what have you. By the time they reach the Earth, it's mostly muons. Okay, for a good reason. But if you send a balloon up to the atmosphere, you can see some of the other particles, like pions. And this is where they were first observed. But you can then ask, how do those particles interact? And this was a big problem in the 50s, and people started doubting even the efficacy of quantum field theory. So I remind you that quantum field theory, its first incarnation was quantum electrodynamics, which is the theory that explains very, very carefully exactly this bound state. And today we have predictions to 12 significant digits of those bound states, okay, and other properties of the electrons. So quantum electrodynamics, which is one example of a QFT, is an extremely successful theory, because we can compute everything, right? And that gave people confidence that we really know now how to merge electrodynamics with quantum mechanics and relativity. But then came strong interactions, and everything seemed hopeless. There was no way of calculating things into nearly as accurately as you can do with quantum electrodynamics. And the problem was that exactly this first thing that we discussed, which is alpha, that quantum electrodynamics is a theory which is weakly coupled. It has alpha, which is 1 over 137 of low energy. that is a small number, and some of you have heard of something called perturbation theory. Perturbation theory is basically a way of calculating things when such small numbers exist. The equivalent of alpha for strong interactions is much greater than 1. Okay, like 4 or so. It depends on the exact scale. So that's clearly not a small number. There is no way you can make an expansion that makes sense. All right? So, but more things emerge. What emerges is that even the particles that you see, even though you can't quite calculate the precise ways they interact and scatter, you see patterns there. You see that those particles and their properties fall into certain nice geometrical shapes. And that's when group theory, Gell-Mann and Neumann, really kicked in to physics, because they realized that those structures can be explained in terms of SU3. Okay, in terms of some representation of SU2, SU3, and group theory can really predict the properties of those particles. So even though we cannot calculate the interactions, we can calculate their properties, and that brings us back to bound states. That we realize that strong interactions play a part in scattering, but it turns out that they're actually also what's creating those particles. And that's the realization of partons, Feynman's partons, quarks, that actually making up those hadrons and mesons that fall under those representations. And those are all bound states. So we started bound states by talking about the atom, right, as a bound state of electron and proton. And in the 50s, we had an expansion of that notion, that we started realizing that in the 60s and 70s, that actually what we call the nucleus itself is a bound state of some strongly interacting theory. Strong bound states. Okay. So again, there is this interplay between scattering and bound states. Okay. And for those of you who laugh because BS stands for something else, well, QCD was not BS. So that's what came out of this. What came out of this is the realization that there is another field theory behind the scenes, and that is QCD, quantum chromodynamics. And it's another incarnation of a quantum field theory, but that is the quantum field theory that governs the quarks that make up the nucleus. Okay. But as I said, as I promised you, whenever you encounter these sort of things, there will be some deep principle that is behind what you're seeing. And the deep principle that we understood here is the idea of asymptotic freedom. And that is the idea that, well, it was already realized by Gell-Mann and Lowe early on, that field theory tells you that couplings run. So this alpha that we wrote here is 1/137. If you go to higher energies, it's no longer 1/137. So, you know, people in the 30s were obsessed about why is it 137, is there a cosmological significance for that? Well, that number is not a constant. If you go to higher energies, it's actually at 100 GeV, it's roughly 1/129. Okay, and it actually grows. But what the realization of QCD brought about is that this running can be the other way around. Rather than going larger at larger energies, this number can actually be smaller at high energies. Now, that by itself is not that interesting, but what it's telling you is that something at your energy scale is blowing up. And that's exactly the idea of bound states in QCD, that this coupling at your low energy is actually going to infinity and you're undergoing a phase transition. So the degrees of freedom that you have here at low energies, at our energies, are not degrees of freedom of QCD, which are quarks and gluons. And that's why it took a long while to figure out what's going on. For quantum molecular dynamics, we know what's going on. We see electrons, we see protons, it's pretty easy. For quantum chromodynamics, it's much harder. Okay. All right, so as far as bound states now, as I said, today the alpha is measured to some 10, 12 significant digits. There are four loops of calculation that go into that. And we have a pretty good idea of those bound states and how to calculate them. Lattice QCD is the way we calculate things for bound states in QCD. There is no way of doing it analytically, so people will devise numerical methods of computing bound states in QCD. And it's becoming so successful that people now can get correctly from a computer the ratio of the different particles that come out of QCD. And think about it, this is truly a triumph of the human mind. We're getting pure numbers, which are the ratios of masses, from some enormous computer, which we threw a simple Lagrangian to. Right, so there is some Lagrangian of QCD that describes this theory, something you can write down on a piece of paper. And that thing is giving you pure numbers, which are independent dimensions. So if an alien civilization out there knows about those real numbers, we can send it to them and then understand what we're sending them. It's a set of like 10, 12 ratios that are defining what this universe is made of. This is truly remarkable. So this is where we are right now. But there is another player in the game which I haven't mentioned yet, because it was not something that was observed by Rutherford. But around the same time, people also start observing the phenomena of radioactivity, right? And radioactivity is something that causes particles to be emitted. In fact, there is some connection, because those particles that he used, the helium nuclei, were actually the products of a radioactive decay. Okay? Now, how do I do this?
So you have to use the fancy electronics.
All right. Cool. Let's see if
you touch it, you'll see.
All right.
There's three movable boards and one in the back that's.
There we go. Okay, I passed my qualifying exam and practice stuff. All right, so people start observing these phenomena of radioactivity and radioactive decay. And one of the particles that was discovered shortly after, or like 20 years after the proton, was the neutron, right, by Chadwick. And it was realized that actually this picture I drew to you over there of a bunch of protons sitting together is not quite accurate. There is another particle that is sitting in between. You cannot see it electromagnetically because it's neutral, and that is the neutron. But the neutron is not a stable particle. If you just take it out of the nucleus, it will decay. Okay, and it decays in about 13 minutes. It decays into a proton and an electron. Right, and that's called beta decay. Now the problem is that, there is that. And there is also the muon that was discovered 40s or 50s, I forget exactly when, and it also decays. It was discovered in the atmosphere, I believe, and it decays into an electron. So this was a weird diagram because it didn't quite satisfy. So when you calculate the energies of those things, it didn't quite satisfy the geomagnetic conservation. This is even crazier because you can see that something is missing here. Right? So people got really worried. Some people suggested to abandon energy momentum conservation. Some people were a little more sane, and they decided that maybe there is just another particle going on here. And these are, of course, the neutrinos. Right. Now, the observation of this phenomenon of beta decay is extremely important, not just because it gives us an understanding of what radioactivity is, but for those of us that care about fundamental particle physics, it comes with something that doesn't come around too often, and that is a new scale. All right. So there is some time scale for this to happen, okay, and that time scale is important because it's a dimension for quantity. Right? And it turns out that if you look very carefully at what's really happening here is there is an exchange muon decays into neutrino through the emission of a vector boson, and this vector boson goes to electron. All right? And while at low energies, this quantum field theory can be described by an unrecognizable operator, there is a UV completion of it in terms of vector bosons. Okay, then we'll see in a moment why those vector bosons are so important. But there is some lesson to be learned for it already about, again, those deep things about quantum field theory, and that is that there is nothing dangerous about non-renormalizable theories. Right? This is a non-renormalizable theory that was invented by Fermi, and it works extremely well. You can calculate things with it, you can calculate decay rates, you can even calculate corrections, quantum corrections. But ultimately, it has to give away to a more to a renormalizable field theory that involves those vector bosons. Now that took a while to develop. That the precise way of defining gauge theories, that this is defined as a gauge theory, and how to renormalize it and how to break it. Was something was a triumph of the 70s. Tooft and others have attacked the problem successfully. And what emerged out of it is another quantum field theory, and that is the electroweak theory. But unlike quantum chromodynamics, and unlike quantum electrodynamics, this theory came with a scale. With a certain mass scale, and it gave rise to again a very deep principle of nature, not just the enumeration of new particles. So here I have a new particle, here is a new particle. Who cares? But there is some deep principle behind it, and that is of symmetry breaking. So this field theory is the vacuum that nature manifests for this field theory. Is actually not the vacuum you would naively expect if you just wrote it down. It's a broken vacuum. And that is what gives rise to the mass of this vector boson, and this is what ultimately allows this decay to happen. If this didn't happen, if this symmetry was not broken, both of these fields would be stable. Now, how many things stable in nature do you know? We know the electron. We know of the proton. Do you know of any other stable particles?
Neutrinos.
So positive neutrinos, good. What other stable particles do you know?
Photon?
Huh?
Photon?
Yeah, if you, yeah. Since quantum mechanics tells us that the wave is a particle, then photon is a particle, then yeah. Anything else? Okay, that's like less than the fingers on my hand. So stable particles are far and few in between, right? And that's one deep realization about particle physics, that it's not so simple. Nature doesn't seem to like to keep things stable, all right? And we'll get to that issue of stability in a moment, but these vector bosons are exactly responsible for the decay of these particles and what makes them unstable. Otherwise, we will see many more stable particles. But there is some deep problem buried in these diagrams. All right? So let me just do something a little technical, and it's not going to be too technical, but something that you could do as a second-year undergraduate when you learn relativity. If it's a vector boson, it's a spin 1, so it's described by 3 polarizations, right? Remember, quantum mechanics telling you that the number of polarization is 2L plus 1, right? So the number of polarization for a spin 1 is 3, right? No?
Massive or massless?
Well, it's clearly massive.
Massive, okay, that
just said that. Yeah, it's a good question, but yeah, it's clearly massive. So quantum mechanics is telling us that those vector bosons should have 3 polarizations. Well, it's relativity, so let's describe those polarizations, right? It's relativity, so I have to have some sort of 4 vector, and we'll ignore the issue, the problematic issue of what you do with the time-like component, but at rest, those 3 polarizations can be described by 1s, right? So this, so if we define that thing moving along the z-axis, those two entries correspond to the transverse motion. You know this from electrodynamics, right? The electromagnetic field oscillates in the transverse direction to the motion, right? That's what makes your polarized glasses workable, because they polarize against the scattering in the earth. But there is also this piece here, which doesn't exist for electromagnetic waves, and that is the monotonal piece. Okay? So let's ignore these guys for a moment and just concentrate on this.
Right.
Now what happens if I boost it? If I now take this particle and I make it move very, very fast? We know from relativity that this vector transforms into, it's multiplied by a matrix, which should look something like, well, exactly like 1, 1, comma, sorry. Right? And I multiply this by 0. Okay? I'm about to show you something that the whole point for the LHC, so pay attention. Okay? I'm serious. So, here is the vector we're going to get. We're going to get something like gamma. And I've dropped the beta because beta, which is V over C, goes to 1. Right? At high enough energies, it's roughly 1. Right? Now, this boost factor, if you remember from your relativity, can be written as the energy divided by the mass of that particle. Right? So at high enough energies, if you boost a vector boson, the polarization goes like energy over mass. That seems innocuous enough, but it's not. The problem with this field theory is that it's not any old field theory. It's actually an Abelian field theory. And there is a prediction there that those vector bosons themselves, not only do they make the neutron decay and the muon decay, they interact among themselves. So this is where we connect decay into scattering. So now I can ask, what if I take those two vector bosons and I scatter them? So I take two of them and I scatter them. Right, so imagine you have some accelerator that you can accelerate those two particles. What happens when you scatter them against each other? There is a prediction in this theory that is not trivial to see. Each one of them comes with some polarization, but the polarization grows with energy. So this diagram should diverge like energy to the fourth power. If the cross section diverges, that means that unitarity is broken, quantum mechanics is breaking down, all hell is coming at us. Right? Now, it's not quite correct. This actually goes like E squared and not into the force because of gauge invariance. So there are some restrictions in this theory, but it still diverges. Now, so what are we saying? Are we saying that quantum mechanics is breaking down and that's why we are running the LHC? That's not quite right. We have a way to resolve this thing. And the way you resolve this problem is the Higgs. This is the whole point for the Higgs mechanism. There is another diagram in the theory that involves the Higgs particle that comes with exactly the same energy behavior but with a minus sign and miraculously cancels it. Now, if you think about it that way, it looks like a miracle, but there are other ways to think about it in which this is very clear and it's you can prove it to all orders. Because one natural question that those of you who are more mathematically inclined, well, you've only proven it to first order. How do you know that it doesn't diverge to higher orders? You're right. But there is a way to prove it to all orders. But this is the point for building the LHC. We would like to see this particle. We would like to see the way this diagram gets unitarized. Okay? So notice the long way we have done from neutron decay and muon decay to what we're doing today in 2011, and that is colliding particles at 10 TeV to see exactly this effect. Okay. So I want to tell you about one last thing that is related to what we mentioned a little while ago about stability, and that's where I'll conclude. So as we enumerated the number of stable particles we saw, and it was about 4 or 5. Now, it turns out that this cannot be enough, or it's not clearly enough. And the problem is that, let me introduce it in a slightly different way. So if you're an astrophysicist and you like astrophysics, good for you. You probably learn all those things at some level because how electrons interact with light affects astrophysical processes. How neutrons get compressed when you have males together affects supernovae. Neutrinos affect processes in the sun. You really need to know your particle physics in order to do astrophysics. Right? So if you really want to understand how things come about in the heavens, which is astrophysics, you really need to know your particle physics. So I would say it's fair to say that in the last 100 years, this was the direction. Okay, you needed to know particle physics to do astrophysics. Not so much the other way around. This is changing. And the reason why it's changing is because astrophysicists have been telling us for about 2 decades now that you guys don't have enough stable particles in your ball. And the reason is dark matter. And it was first observed in clusters of galaxies in the way they rotate. It was now observed in all scales, galaxies themselves, if you measure how stars in the galaxies rotate, how neutral hydrogen rotates in the galaxies, you find a very strange curve. So if you draw the velocity versus the distance, so how many of you know how far are we from the center of the galaxy?
Somewhere at the edge.
Say it again?
Somewhere at the edge of galaxy, but without number.
Somewhere at the edge of what?
Of galaxy.
No, but how far are we? Somewhere at the edge of the galaxy. Yeah, that's roughly correct.
8 kiloparsec,
thank you. So this is where we are. It's good to know where you are in life. You can measure how things rotate on the edge, and you know, for example, we know roughly how fast we are rotating. And you measure that, and you plot it, and it looks something like this, or something like this. Depends. There are no curves actually. Now, this is very strange, right? If most of the matter in the galaxy is at the center or close to the center, which is what we see if we look at how much light there is, then just Newtonian dynamics tell us that this curve should actually go down, right? Because as you go to larger scales, your density falls faster than you're capturing volume. Right? But this is not what's observed. What's observed is a flattening of the rotation. And this is not just our galaxy, it's in many other galaxies as well. We see it everywhere now. And we even see it on scales of clusters of galaxies. So that's one indication that something is missing. Now, moreover, there are other sort of indications that appeared early on. And that is, for example, the spiral galaxies, like our galaxy, is actually not a stable thing. If that was the only thing around, if that matter, the visible matter, is the only thing you see, the stable galaxy, that spiral galaxy is not a stable dynamic configuration. And what can make it stable, so elliptical galaxies, which are, I don't know if you know the terms, but elliptical galaxy is more like a ball, and it's holding itself by the kinetic pressure. Our galaxy is not holding itself by kinetic pressure, it's supposed to be holding it by rotation, but that's not enough. So that is, again, when the realization shined upon people that you need an additional component that will imitate what happens in elliptical galaxies to keep the structure stable. Okay? Long story short, dark matter. It's a very simple term. It just means that it's not luminous. Now, dark matter doesn't mean necessarily that this is something that we've not accounted for, because maybe it's just some form of gas that you have not quite seen. This was indeed the case. People discovered that in clusters of galaxies, there is a lot of hot gas that was just not observed because you were not looking at the right part of the spectrum. They emit in the X-rays, you were looking below that and you didn't see it. And that amounts to a large, very large fraction of some of the missing stuff. So dark matter doesn't necessarily mean exotic things. At least initially, people didn't even imagine that this would be something exotic. And it can still not be, it's not necessarily something exotic. I'll tell you one more caveat, is that it could also be a modification of Newton's laws or gravitational attraction. We don't have any empirical evidence that says that there is definitely some matter out there that is just not luminous. Okay. Everything we see are astrophysical observations. So it could be that somehow our laws of gravitation are wrong. But leaving that aside, in the last 20 or so years, there are more and more ideas around dark matter as a form of a new particle. So we saw in particle physics it's hard to come about a stable configuration. But it's not impossible. The electron is stable, proton is stable. So maybe there is another stable particle out there that is responsible for what we see as dark matter. And I'm not going to throw too many details at you, but it turns out that that problem is deeply connected with the problem of the Higgs. Okay? There are some difficulties of explaining why is it that the Higgs or the scale of the electron weak is where it is. Why is it that the scale is where it is? Why is it not the God scale or the Planck scale or any other scale? Right? And that problem led to the idea of supersymmetry, which is a new idea, new space-time symmetry. And in the same way that there are symmetries that protect the proton from decaying, there are symmetries that protect the electron from decaying, there could be some other symmetry like supersymmetry that may give us another stable particle. So this is where I'm about to end. I'll just mention that there is a possibility that we have another stable particle hiding somewhere, and this will be where astrophysics will start to feed into particle physics and informing us of other forms of matter which we have not quite encountered before. So why don't we turn this into a more informal question session, and you can ask me not whatever you want, because I won't answer every question, but anything about this. How many of you care for particle physics? Oh, okay. I think I'm talking to a bunch of biologists. Wrong audience. Yeah.
That's better. The first time will be a time polarization?
Right.
Yeah, in the E over M?
Right.
What would that be?
This is just, in this case, it's just because, you know, relativity mixes space and time. So if you start with a spatial component, you will mix in the time component. Polarization really, right, so because your imagination, polarization is really only defined in the rest. When you have a particle with a spin, the spin can point this way, and this way. Right? But once you boost that thing, your imagination can no longer quite capture that because that gets mixed in with... But maybe where your imagination is right, that this is not a physical degree of freedom. The physical degrees of freedom that actually end up coming out of the diagram are only these ones, the spatial ones.
Maybe a question, because I mean, your origin of vector for a vector has a length, or has a scalar product which is non-zero. That's the last one is zero. Is this?
Well, but remember that it's all in the large boost limit. So there are corrections here. So I'm writing just the pieces which are there only the large n limit, and that limit, that vector is massless. Yeah.
Should you have gamma gamma at the diagonal of the Lorentz matrix?
No, you're not boosting the transverse components.
Okay.
Right? I'm imagining here, here is the transverse component. I'm boosting in this direction. So all the transverse parts don't get moved around. Only the longitudinal piece gets boosted.
What if beta goes to zero?
If beta goes, thank you. I think I had it right originally. Thank you. This should be, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Do you think we will find supersymmetry in the near future?
I don't think, I'll let nature speak. Sorry. We're empirical scientists, not philosophers.
So when we're talking about stable particles, why do we not consider atoms?
That's an excellent question. So one of the triumphs of cosmology, as we know it today, is the precise prediction of hydrogen to helium ratios, of hydrogen to lithium ratios. And those all come from a picture where you start with protons and electrons, and then as the universe cools down, they come together and start binding. And at that point, you have both neutrons, protons, and electrons around. But before that, you have some, before that, there is some depletion of the number of neutrons. So you have all those things coming together, and current cosmology, as we understand it, you can only get up to very light elements early on. So scattering will produce only very light elements. All the heavy elements are producing stars. Okay, so those predictions tell us something about how much hydrogen we should see, and that's roughly what we see. So it doesn't quite leave you space where you're going to get those other atoms from.
Well, I mean, that theory could be wrong, right?
Theory could be wrong, but if you want to go that route, you will have to come up with an alternative that does explain all of the other things that we see. That is, for example, the very precise predictions of the CMB, the fact that we do get the light elements correctly.
So do we observe the light elements?
Oh, yeah. Predictions.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, those predictions, there is only one anomaly there, which is the lithium fix ratio,
okay.
But by and large, those fall right into CMB prediction.
So essentially, all the atoms are accounted for. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
So we need something else.
That's right. Now I should say that. Right. Yeah. So anything like that, it is possible, but you really have to come up with an entire new scheme to make the whole thing.
So what's the anomaly in the lithium 6 ratio?
Oh, as far as I know, it's not quite agreeing with prediction.
Okay.
I mean, it's a difficult measurement, so who knows? But the current prediction from the concordance model of cosmology give values that is not agreeing with experiment. Yeah.
Could you explain a bit more how the gauge bosons acquire mass?
What are you looking for?
Whatever can be done in 5 minutes.
I like your definition. Yeah, sure. So, let me give you a very heuristic picture, and I can also give you some more mathematical picture. So the heuristic picture is that if you have some sort of field, another field, which is in fact the Higgs field, that has some expectation value, the vacuum has some expectation value, that means that the vacuum value is not zero, Okay, there is some energy density associated with the vacuum of that field. And that is represented by something like this. Okay, so normally you'd expect the vacuum to have zero expectation value. That is the usual picture. For the Higgs, there is actually non-zero value for that energy. So now if there's any things that interact with that field, it will feel the vacuum. Right? Diagrammatically, if I have some diagram that looks like this, right? Here is my Higgs field, here is my Higgs field, here is a W boson that we discussed. The theory actually has a diagram like that. So that diagram leads to scattering, right? If I take two W bosons, it will scatter into two Higgses. But if my vacuum is actually some medium, then those Ws are swimming in this medium. Even if I don't produce any Higgses myself, the vacuum constantly has those Higgses around. So now as those vector bosons propagate through the vacuum, they're really propagating from some medium. And in the same way that it's harder to go through water than it is through air, you're picking some sort of inertia. Okay? So this is a very heuristic picture. And it's a little more than just a heuristic picture because if you know some elements of field theory, this two-point function, right? I'm now putting it to an external field. Then this two-point function is really the propagator of W boson, right? And you're saying that this propagator has a non-zero pole at some value that is associated with the vev of this field. Okay. Let me stop there. You can fill up on some of the details. If you actually know some field theory, you start with some SU2 gauge theory, right? And suppose you have some scalars that is in the two. Actually, you don't even have to do SU2. Let's do U1, right? U1 theory. That is actually relevant for superconductivity. A very similar phenomenon happens with superconductivity, and John can tell you a lot about it. But it's the basic idea is that what's playing the role of the Higgs here is a Cooper pair. It's actually a bound state of two fermions in a sense. But it's the same idea. They're forming some sort of medium against which the photon has to propagate. Now, the fact that the photon has mass is exactly known from superconductivity. It's called the London effect. I'm forgetting the fact
yeah,
that
the decay of
that's right. The penetration, the decay length into the material,
yeah.
Right? And you can derive all of it from Maxwell's equation directly if you just put a mass term for the photon. But in relativistic, so all of it has nothing to do with relativistic field theory. But I will write it down as a relativistic field theory. And so we have this field. Let's call it a mu, okay, like the photon. And we have some charge scalar. So it has, you have phi and you have phi star, a complex conjugate. And if you have seen Lagrangians before, so those of you who have not seen Lagrangians, this is not essential. I'll just say it for the sake of 5 minutes. We know that it will look something like this. The Lagrangian looks something like that. And if I write in detail, there is, of course, the usual kinetic term, right? But then there are some interactions that's telling me that this particle is actually charged under the gauge boson, and you can even write for yourself because it's just about replacing indices plus remission conjugate. And the most important term is exactly the kind of diagram I drew. It's two vector bosons and two scalars, right? So if you expand this kinetic term, this is exactly what you'll get. Right? This theory also has the usual Maxwell term, which is minus 1/4 F mu. How many of you have seen this? Okay. So you'll be living on this one. this thing, as you know, describes 2 degrees of freedom, which goes back to your question. If it's a massless vector boson, this thing only describes 2 degrees of freedom. But let's see what's about to happen. But notice that this is a quadratic operator, right? It has only the field square, and that's describing the propagator or the kinetic term. But if I now, if my vacuum is such that phi is non-zero on the vacuum, then even if I don't excite anything in the vacuum, so that means that this is not there because excitation corresponds to a non-zero derivative. This is not there because excitation corresponds to non-zero derivative. But this is there, right? It's just the vacuum expectation value of this field. Now, you know this from quantum mechanics, because if you take a double well potential, right, the vacuum of this theory is not when the field, or whatever you like to call it, is zero. It's when it's non-zero, right? And this is precisely what's happening here. And notice that this term now is a quadratic operator, right? It has the two vector bosons. And now if you can just forget about all the rest, you just attach this to the Maxwell equation, and you'll get superconductivity. Okay? You can do a generalization of that to SU2, but that will take us too far afield. 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Anything else? Yeah.
So how does that lead to the neutron and muon being unstable?
Good. So we can see it from here, okay? Let me not attempt that. Right, okay. So suppose you take the electron, right? The electron interacts with electromagnetism. As far as you know, that's the only system. Well, maybe you know that. Now just duplicate this field. So you have another partner of that electron that also only interacts with electromagnetism. Mm-hmm. So what are the only processes allowed in that theory? The only processes allowed, if it only interacts with electromagnetism, then you can only have a muon to a muon with electromagnetism, or an electron to an electron. The other term will violate gauge invariance. So in this theory, the muon is exactly stable. Right? But then there are neutrinos. But neutrinos are not very good because electromagnetism cannot take a charged particle to a neutral particle. That would be a travesty. Right? But the vector bosons, the W plus W minus, have the right quantum numbers to allow that to happen. And indeed, this is exactly what happens. The muons and neutrinos are, remember I told you that this is an SU2 theory, that it's actually an SU2 plus U1, and therefore, so U1 are trivial theories because things are a billion. SU2 means that the underlying representation is some vector that is more than, so it can connect muon to neutrinos, and that's exactly what it does. The W plus W minus allow this transition to happen, right? Now, it's true that this is not a real transition because this particle is much heavier than the muon. But quantum mechanics is wonderful. It allows us to do things which are not real and take this Kalf shell and decay into an electron neutrino. Okay? So that's why the electroweak theory makes muons and in a similar fashion neutrons. Unstable, because they can decay, and therefore they will. That's the general rule of quantum mechanics. If something can happen, it will happen.
So, without symmetry breaking, you wouldn't have a W plus.
Without symmetry breaking, Yeah, I should be a little more careful about it.
You still would have the
mixing. You will still decay. It will take a little more to keep those stable. So that's
okay.
But with even if we didn't have symmetry breaking, those guys were massless. It will still decay. There is a way to nevertheless make them stable. But thank you. Anything else?
Okay. So let's thank Dr.